everybody. Welcome, welcome. Today I am extremely fortunate in that I have managed to persuade Dr. Nihara Kraus to talk to us about eating disorders. Dr. Kraus is an award-winning consultant clinical psychologist. She's a lecturer. She's an international speaker. She's the founder and CEO of STEM4, which is a teenage mental health charity. She has created wellbeing and resilience programs for schools. She's developed two apps, the Calm Harm and Clear Fear apps for teenagers to help them manage anxiety and self-harm. She has been the mentor for mental health for the Youth Health Parliament. She's on the BPS, which is the British Psychological Society expert group, advising the government on mental health policy. She's very often on TV, radio and in the press. But today we are talking about eating disorders, and Nihara is an expert, having developed and headed a specialist NHS eating disorders service for day and outpatients. So she's specialised in complex eating disorder presentations, including eating disorders and health self-harm, and research-specific treatment approaches. So I think you will agree that I am very fortunate to have managed to persuade her to join us today. Nihara, welcome, and thank you so much.
No, thank you for inviting me.
It's a pleasure. So just to start off with, I think it would be really helpful to explain what an eating disorder looks like.
Yes, of course. So eating disorders are complicated to describe, and it's because, of course, we all eat. We all have our own feelings about food and weight and shape, and our own kind of feelings about how eating might work with us or not in a way. So it's complex. But in general, an eating disorder is when somebody develops an unhealthy relationship with food. They have a poor body image, which might then lead them to regulate food in a way that makes them very unwell. And, you know, as per many mental health conditions, eating disorders lie along a spectrum. So you might start off with individuals who might be fussy eaters or fatty eaters or who have food phobias. And I also want to say that some of these are age-related. So, you know, to have a fatty five-year-old is not in any way an eating disorder. Mm-hmm. It's part of the age range as they get older. But true eating disorders will move along the spectrum and fall clinically into four main groups. And they're diagnosed as anorexia nervosa, which is when people lose a certain degree of body weight and they have a number of accompanying other symptoms that cause quite serious physical and mental health issues. Bulimia nervosa is the second condition, where people will alternate between restricting their eating and then binge eating and taking steps to get rid of the food in a variety of different ways. Mm-hmm. The third category is called binge eating disorder, when people, very similar to bulimia nervosa, will binge eat, but they won't take any steps to get rid of the food they eat. And then more recently, there's been a fourth category called other specified feeding and eating disorders. And these are conditions that don't match completely the symptoms of anorexia nervosa or binge eating disorder, but are similarly serious.
So there is quite a spectrum there, and presumably different, you know, depending on which one you're struggling with, there'll be a spectrum as to the symptoms that you'd expect to see.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So does an eating disorder generally start as a method for coping with other mental health problems or inability to cope with feelings? What's your take on why they begin?
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting question, Alicia. I'm really pleased you've asked me this, because, you know, what is an eating disorder, a coping technique, as you say, or actually is an eating disorder a mental ill health condition in its own right? And I think that, again, it's a bit of a complicated answer, so I'm afraid I'm going to be slightly long-winded in this, but often eating disorders emerge when there's a dissatisfaction with weight and shape. There's very often issues around self-esteem or self-worth, so these tend to be low. In answer to your question, yes, they can arise as a way of coping with other mental ill health difficulties, depression, for example, it's very common, or social anxiety. And many people with an eating disorder will mention the concept of control, and this will primarily be in relation to trying to control their emotions, which mm-hmm. they might feel they don't want to express, or actually because they feel their emotions are all out of control. And that is all relevant to all eating disorders at some level. But I think what's very important to also remember is that eating disorders do have a biological basis. So they do tend to run in families, and they can also be highly influenced in vulnerable young people by their peers, and can sometimes be a result of trauma. So as I said, apologies for a long-winded explanation, but I think they're a bit of both. They can be a mental ill health condition on their own, or they can be a method for coping with mental health problems.
Yeah. It's incredibly complex work, actually. And do you think, why do you think girls are more likely to develop eating disorders than boys? Because we know that boys do.
Yes. Well, I mean, just to put things in frame, about a quarter of the clinical population, so those who present with anorexia nervosa, bulimia nervosa and binge eating disorders to clinical services, quarter of them are boys. And I think it's tempting, isn't it, to talk about sociocultural issues. So, you know, do we as a society value thinness? And also, of course, there's lots of issues around gender. So is it harder for girls and women to be successful? Are we judged more on our looks? And most importantly, is there a difference in terms of self-esteem as a result between women and men? And is women's self-esteem more connected with physical? And I think it's true to say that that's absolutely the case. We have to think about sociocultural issues. But I am particularly keen on stressing the relevance to the biology of being female and to the biology of being female at puberty, because I do think that there is something about the way that the female body is built, the way that fat is stored, the way that hormones play a role that impact quite significantly on women's attitude to their shape and to their weight. And also, just that as a little side comment, boys actually may have an eating disorder, but they might show it differently. So it's not unusual for boys to binge eat, you know, mm-hmm. but do we in society just say, well, they have a healthy appetite, rather than perhaps acknowledging, you know, that there might be an issue that might be going on. They might show their eating disorder through bodybuilding rather than weight loss. So again, we have to start to look a little at the differences in definition.
So culture, gender, and you mentioned puberty. Is that often
yes.
when eating disorders start?
Absolutely. So puberty often is seen as a trigger for the start of an eating disorder.
Another, do you think there are personality traits which make some people perhaps more vulnerable than others?
Yes, I think that's another really great question. And I would say yes. So I've already mentioned low self-esteem and lack of social confidence. But certainly, I think in anorexia nervosa, people who are highly competitive, perfectionist. So in fact, clinical perfectionism is one of the diagnostic features of anorexia nervosa, mm-hmm. those individuals who are very emotionally controlled or emotionally disciplined, for example, mm-hmm. and in binge eating disorder and bulimia nervosa, sometimes the opposite. So low self-worth again and social confidence creeps in, but generally personality-wise, more impulsive, poor emotional regulation, and possibly people who look for short-term solutions rather than perhaps being able to stop, wait, and reflect a little on the long-term impact of things.
Yeah. So at the moment, there is a huge growth, obviously, in the vegan diet movement and vegetarian and deep vegans and very healthy ways to go. But do you think that they perhaps provide a hiding place for somebody who's developing disordered eating habits?
Tricky to answer, because as you said, you know, there are, it's absolutely great that young people are becoming vegan and vegetarian for very good reasons in relation to the planet, etc. Mm-hmm. But interestingly, there was a study that was carried out quite a while ago that looked at what type of diets people with eating disorders had. And in general, about 80% of people who have an eating disorder opt to be vegetarian or indeed vegan. And I think that I think the way to suss out whether you're hiding behind the diet would be to look at whether the diet included food that all had low calories. So for example, if you're vegetarian or if you're vegan, you know, you can have a pizza or you might have pasta, and these things would be part of a so-called normal healthy diet. But if the person has become vegetarian or vegan round about the same time that their eating disorder started and their diet has switched to having all the low calorie food that accompanies vegetarianism and veganism. So for example, if they are eating salads because they're vegetarian, or they've switched to having almond milk because it's got lower fat than having cow's milk, then you have to start to see that the diet is actually more related to the eating disorder rather than to the values that the person has.
Yeah, it's so interesting, isn't it? We're trying to work out. So as a parent, what signs should you really watch out for? So as you say, if they're doing it to restrict calories, but what else would you be looking out for?
Yes, well, because there are so many different reasons for why young people develop an eating disorder, I think parents need to look out for lots of different signs. So the first is physical. Mm-hmm. And if you have got either anorexia nervosa or binge eating disorder, then you might see either a loss or constant fluctuation in weight. Mm-hmm. Bulimia nervosa is much harder because it's hidden. You might not notice anything weight-wise. Other physical symptoms, stopping of periods if they've started them, occasionally a loss of an increase in body hair, mm-hmm. impact on skin. So you might have lots of spots, something that looks a bit like a measles-like rash, hair thinning, tiredness, sleep disturbance. Behaviors are probably some of the things that parents are most likely to spot. So they might notice, again, you know, differences in eating, strange eating mm-hmm. habits, often taking a very long time to finish their meals, trying to actively burn up calories, becoming really strict and rigid about what they want to eat. They might be obsessively gathering information on the internet about eating. They might be weighing themselves a lot. They might be drinking very large quantities of water. A lot of social avoidance. So, you know, kind of not going out for meals, not wanting to go out with the family for meals, making their own meals, which tend to be very low calorie, and very high levels of emotional distress or high levels of anxiety and mood. And of course, this is difficult if you've got a teen, because yes. of course, their moods will be varied and they will be wanting to do their own things. So I think you've got to look for a change, but a change that's having a negative effect on them.
And gosh, there's so much going on in there. Every time that you finish talking, I'm thinking, oh, I wanted to pick out about four different things that you just said. But I suppose in terms of the purging as well, you know, that's another thing to look out for.
Oh, yes, you're right. Yes, of course. So perhaps going, you know, leaving the dining table immediately after they've eaten, mm-hmm. going to the bathroom, you know, to be able to get rid of food. The other thing, of course, with the binge eating disorder and bulimia is that some of the signs that a parent might see is that their cupboards are, you know, empty, or that they are potentially going to the toilet after a meal, as I mentioned, or perhaps doing lots of exercise. And that will be true of all eating disorders.
Yeah. And I think parental modelling, where do you think that fits in all of this?
Well, I think that what is important is, as I mentioned earlier, there is quite a strong biological and learning component that comes from families. So I do think that what's helpful for parents is to recognize that not only will the young person bring their own experiences and their personality into the development of an eating disorder, but the role model that parents provide. So if you are a parent who has got issues around your self-esteem, the way you relate to food and eating, whether perhaps, you know, do you eat with the family? Do you cook different foods for you? Are you constantly on a diet? Are you very critical about your own or other people's weight? All of those things will be providing young people with some sort of an idea about the value that you as a parent give to food and to eating, or the difficulties that there might be there. So if you are a parent and you do have food related issues or body related issues, then I would really recommend that you seek some support for yourself, but also really start to think a little bit about how as a family you might work together in bringing about a healthier model towards yourself as a person and to eating.
Yeah, because we know that when one member of the family has an eating disorder, the impact on the rest of the family is immense.
Yes. No, I'm a big fan of supporting siblings, because the impact is really huge, I think, on everyone, but particularly siblings. So I think it's worth keeping an eye on them too.
Yeah, definitely. And I suppose there is still, sadly, some people who find it very difficult to access help because it's frightening. There's a lot of shame perhaps around admitting that, you know, your child's got an eating disorder. I think, I don't know if it's your experience, but certainly, you know, parents that I've talked to, you're looking to yourself thinking, what have I done wrong? And actually that's not really always very helpful, I don't think.
Oh, no, not at all. And I think that, you know, I think for parents, it's also recognizing there's a lot of secrecy that goes on with eating disorders, which also makes it quite difficult. And often you might have a reluctant child or a young person who doesn't want to let you see that there might be something wrong or indeed seek help. And in those instances, I'd say, you know, if you are concerned, seek help yourself. So go and take, you know, the case to your GP or to whoever you might see, describe the problem and say that you've got a reluctant young person, but you're worried about what that might look like. And I think for parents who might not know where to access help, what I would say is, because eating disorders have such a big impact physically, what's very, very important is to see your GP, who can then escalate the referral based on their assessment to, there are community eating disorder teams and specialist children and adolescent mental health services as part of the NHS offer, and to make sure that they are offered a combination of treatment. So they need their physical health monitored, they need their psychological health and well-being attended to, and this can often be quite long term, but they also need some support on nutrition and on activity.
So it is a whole team approach.
Yes, indeed.
Because I know you mentioned in your bio that you have done some research on the best specific treatment approaches. Is there one that you favour over others, or?
Well, it depends on the form of eating disorder, really. So for anorexia nervosa, there are a range of treatments. They generally they focus on a combination of nutrition alongside psychological intervention. And if you're under 16, and including family treatment and family therapy. So something that has got a cognitive underpinning, but also a bit more of an emotional element. So cognitive analytic therapy, for example, looking alongside schema-focused work. So these are good treatments for anorexia nervosa. And there's also a specific CBT model for anorexia nervosa. For bulimia nervosa, CBT specifically for eating disorders is very successful. And so it's absolutely worth seeking some specialist help.
Yeah, definitely. So if you, for schools as well, because in my experience working in schools, you will find clusters of young people who are exploring their eating habits. What advice do you give to schools?
Well, I think that I think a little bit about the messaging, first of all. So I think sometimes education on healthy eating and nutrition, depending on the child or young person, may be taken a bit too literally. I would say have discussions and talks about mental health in general and about how a friend might be able to pick up and support a young person and what those lines of reporting there might be there. Have workshops and talks for parents on eating issues, so that again parents know what to look out for, potentially have resource within the school to pick up on some of these issues. Mm-hmm. One of the things that young people would be recommended if they're trying to recover from an eating disorder is some sort of supported eating. So the school may then want to think about who within the school is best placed to offer that sort of support. And picking up on your point, Alicia, about clusters of young people, I think with most mental ill health conditions, it's very easy, isn't it, to have what sounds a little bit like a contagion. You know, young people, through curiosity, by being young, want to explore what somebody else might be doing. Mm-hmm. And most of the time, you might have a group of young people exploring the same thing. But I think what often happens is that once they've done it and it doesn't work for you, the young person who isn't vulnerable will move on. Mm-hmm. But of course, for another young person who maybe also has low self-esteem or is a bit of a perfectionist or kind of mirrors some of these issues, then that becomes something that's also impactful. So I think, you know, being able to look at groups of friends, being able to support a friend to kind of go, actually, I can't be the person who's my friend's helper. I need to start to look a little bit at what, how it's affecting me, yeah, is also very useful.
So this is a question I want to ask you, because I remember reading it once, and I've never actually got to the bottom of whether it's true or not, that an eating disorder has a genetic component to it, and that there are mm-hmm. two genes specifically associated with an eating disorder, and those two genes have to mutate in order for somebody to go on and develop a full eating disorder, and that's kind of influenced by your environment, your personality, your biology. Is that correct?
I think there's a lot of research on looking at genes in terms of eating disorders, and that has come, that piece of research you mentioned has come from looking at twins who are identical, and then looking at how they might have been brought apart and looking at whether they have that gene structure and whether those genes have come together. There's a lot more research that has to be carried out, because of course we have a number of young people where we don't know about those gene mutations. Yeah. So I think there's a bit more studies to be carried out. But there is some scope to say that there is some sort of genetic coding for eating disorders, addictions. They all seem to run along a similar plane of genetic coding.
Mm. And I know that a couple of, certainly this, I don't know whether it's quite so much the case now, but some people who had long-term eating disorders, I know two people that I can think of straight off who actually ended up being treated in addiction clinics rather than an eating disorder. I mean, I know the two run alongside, but there is that element to it, isn't there?
Indeed. And I think that some people, particularly if they binge eat on food, will liken it in a similar way physically to the way they feel to binging on alcohol or binging on a substance. So there is an addictive quality, particularly if you're binging on sugar, for example. And of course, some of the behaviors in themselves are very compulsive and also carry that same element of an addiction. So at some level, you have to treat the whole condition as something that's self-soothing and therefore also needs some support with making that change, having alternatives.
Yeah. So anorexia, I know, has the highest mortality rate of any mental illness. And I was listening to or reading Caitlin Moran actually talking about the 30-30-30 risk. So that 30% recover completely, 30% recover to a point, but then live with some form of disordered eating, and 30% do not recover or sadly die. Is that reflective of your experience of working with eating disorders?
I think that's a very scary statistic for a parent in particular to hear. Yeah. So that statistic comes from a study that was carried out by a psychologist called Strober in 1997. And what that study looked at was the rate of recovery of adults. It wasn't young people who had anorexia nervosa for more than 5 to 10 years. So it was sort of more of a long-term pattern. And with that group of people, it's true to say that the longer you have an eating disorder and the more severe that eating disorder is over that period of time, the less likely you may be to have full recovery. So those were the statistics that that Strober described. I think it would be true to say that now, because of awareness, early intervention, and picking up certainly in childhood and adolescence much quicker, there's a much better outcome for children and young people. So if you've had it for under 5 years, you can really look towards much improved recovery. And with bulimia nervosa, again, much better rate of recovery, but early intervention, I can't stress enough, is so important.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so relieved to hear that, because when I read that, I thought, oh gosh, yeah.
Yes.
So early intervention, utterly crucial, but I think often families don't seek help perhaps swiftly enough. In your experience, why do you think that happens? I mean, we talked about shame, but at what point do you think parents should intervene?
Yes, I think it's so hard because you've got this sort of intervening adolescence that comes in and changes your child or young person. So it becomes so difficult to separate out and think, you know, is what I'm seeing part of growing up, or is what I'm seeing something that I should be really concerned about? So if you do have a child who is showing quite significant change, they've lost weight, they seem to be really quite preoccupied with what they're doing, if you know that they've got some of those characteristics I mentioned, you know, some of those personality characteristics, or they've gone through a difficult time, if perhaps they're avoiding being with their friends, then I would say that it is time to act. There is absolutely no blame that is placed on parents. It's very much about an acknowledgement that goes on about the young person being unwell and then treating the illness rather than looking to attribute blame to anyone.
Yeah, I don't think playing the blame game helps anybody, does it?
No.
And I think often I have spoken to young people who worry about a friend of theirs who's developing unhealthy or unhelpful eating habits, and they don't really know what to do or what to say. What advice would you give a young person?
I think I would say to them, talk to your friend. You know, talk to them not about the eating or about the changes in their behavior, but just talk to them about how they are, whether they're worried about something. Be prepared to talk to them over a number of sessions rather than just the one. I think what's very important is to remember that you're their friend, not their therapist. And so, you know, remember to sort of do all the things that help you to build and strengthen that connection. And it might be that you find that your friend has changed. You know, they might be a bit more irritable. They might be avoiding you. That you might realize that they're lying to you. And all of those things can make you feel quite angry or hurt or upset. And so I think, again, it would be helpful to sort of realize that they're scared and offer to support them by taking them to talk to a responsible adult who can help. So you can encourage them to try and get help, or else say to them, can I come with you and can I help and support you to get the help that you want? And I would also say to a friend, if you're really, really worried about your friend and they're refusing to get help, then you can always talk to a responsible adult, a teacher, a sibling, a parent, and you can do that in confidence. They don't have to say, you know, you've told tales. Yeah. And just say, I'm really worried about my friend. Is there anything that you can do? And as I mentioned before, please also look after yourself.
Yes, so that's just so important, isn't it? And yeah. It's not your responsibility to make that other person better, is it?
Yes, exactly.
So I think, so supporting everybody, you know, it's that ripple effect, isn't it? Supporting everybody who is friends or related to somebody with an eating disorder is so important.
Absolutely.
Yeah, the advice for parents, because advice for a parent whose child is, you know that they've got a developed an eating disorder, so there'll be focus and hopefully help, although I know that accessing help via CAMHS at the moment can be extremely challenging because they are so busy, aren't they?
Yes, indeed. Yeah, it's very hard for parents, isn't it? So, you know, obviously act quickly. Keep talking and you know, try and find out what's happening. I think it's very helpful to start to think about talking about not just eat, because a lot of young people say actually our whole focus, our whole relationship has become all about eating. You know, it's telescoped into nothing else, and yet I'm a person and I've got worries about my friends and I've got worries about my exams. So I'd say talk and just remember the person that's behind them. one of the things I find very useful to tell parents is to see the young person in front of you as not only your son or daughter, but also as a person who has an eating disorder. Because if they're lying to you, if they're, you know, secretly hiding food, if they're having huge rages, see that as part of the eating disorder and see it as they're really frightened. So if you've got a very fearful person, it might not appear like they're frightened. You need to then cultivate a relationship which helps them to get over their fear in order to face the treatment. And the treatment's all about facing fear, because it's about eating, it's about gaining weight, it's about managing their eating disorder differently. Mm-hmm. I think educating yourselves as a parent is really very helpful. So, you know, try and access information from web. There's lots of very good websites. There's books. You've already mentioned the importance of looking at their contribution, what they might bring. Mm-hmm. And for parents who perhaps have somebody who's binge eating, I'd say shop wisely and, you know, don't talk about diets, but just sort of cook wisely too. So that way around, you're helping, but you're helping in a very discreet and non-judgmental way.
So yeah, keeping the food healthy and not putting perhaps the stuff there that would be too difficult for them to resist.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Yes. So it might be that if we could put a little list of resources, that the websites that you would recommend, because I think the web has played its part as well, doesn't it? Because I know there has been a lot, certainly in the press, about websites where you can learn to be a better anorexic, and those I just think are really frightening for everybody, because.
Absolutely. And again, it's part of the education that a parent has to do. So I would try and see whether, if you're really concerned, try and check what websites they're visiting. So there are pro-anorexia websites, and they do provide information on how to be better at an eating disorder. There's also actually pro-weight loss through exercise websites, where there's very specific information given on how much you have to exercise, very specific information on how much, you know, what you can do to purge, etc. So I would really try and know a little bit about their online history, and again have some sort of ongoing discussion about some healthier models that they can follow, and also think a little bit about who they follow, because certain vloggers and bloggers have got their own issues, and while some are hugely helpful, quite a few may well not be.
I think quite a few very definitely aren't, actually. Some of the stuff, it's toxic, some of the things, and I suppose the internet, you know, having an eating disorder in the age of social media has added a whole level of complexity to it, hasn't it?
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
So just before we kind of finish off, what advice would you give a young person who's considering using disordered eating as a way of coping with their feelings?
Well, what I would say is that, you know, disordered eating doesn't help you to cope with your feelings. Find sources of support to deal with. You know, feelings are difficult to deal with. They can affect how we see ourselves. They can affect our relationships. But there are very many helpful ways, just from, you know, even if it's sort of doing something that's soothing, to talking to a friend, all the way through to a range of very helpful and effective treatments available. So it doesn't work is probably the most simple explanation, I would say, is, you know, it doesn't work. So don't go down that route, because what you use to cope will in itself become the problem.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you were leaving us with just one last piece of advice, what would it be?
I would say, you know, work on recognizing the person you are, really work on developing your sense of self-esteem and self-acceptance. We are all beautiful in our own way. We've just got to find what that is.
Oh, that's such a lovely way to finish. Dr. Nahara Kraz, I am deeply, deeply grateful, and I think this will be extremely helpful for an awful lot of people. So thank you so much for giving up your time this afternoon. I found it fascinating, and I'm sure that it will be really, really helpful. So thank you so, so much.
Thank you very much indeed.
It's a pleasure.